My Dearest Cousin by Keith Spence. A conversation between William Cooper and his dear cousin Lady Harriet Hesketh in the years 1785 and 1786, drawn from his correspondence. Theirs was a friendship which went back over the years to his youth, but which was renewed after a period of a 20 years gap, when out of the blue she suddenly wrote to him one day. Cooper had been living with his housekeeper, Mary Unwin, in Olney, in Buckinghamshire, and his dearest hope was that one day he might meet his cousin again. Hark, 'tis the twanging horn. O yonder bridge, that with its wearisome but needful length bestrides the winter flood, in which the moon sees her unwrinkled face reflected bright, he comes, the herald of a noisy world, with spattered boots, strapped waist and frozen locks, news from all nations lumbering at his back. True to his charge, the close-packed load behind, yet careless what he brings. His one concern is to conduct it to the destined inn, and having dropped the expected bag, pass on. He whistles as he goes. Light-hearted wretch, cold and cheerful. Messenger of grief, perhaps, to thousands, and of joy to some. To him, indifferent, whether grief or joy. Houses in ashes and the fall of stocks. Births, deaths, marriages, epistles wet with tears that trickle down the writer's cheeks fast as the periods from his fluent quill, or charged with amorous sighs of absent swains, or nymphs responsive, equally affect his horse and him, unconscious of them all. My morning mail. A letter from Mary, one from William, and, upon my word, a frank from Uncle Ashley. And what is here inside but a letter from my cousin Harriet? I thought to write as a line or two may not be disagreeable to you. No, indeed, it is most agreeable. Oh, I must reply at once. October 12, 1785. My dearest cousin, it is no new thing with you to give pleasure, but I will venture to say you do not often give me more than you gave me this morning when I came down to breakfast and found a letter from you. I said within myself, this is just as it should be. We're all grown young again, and the days I thought I should see no more are actually returned. You perceive, therefore, that you judged well when you conjectured that a line from you would not be disagreeable to me. It could not be otherwise than as, in fact, it proved a most agreeable surprise. Truly I can boast of an affection for you which neither years nor interrupted intercourse have at all abated. I need only recollect how much I valued you once, and with how much cause, immediately to feel a revival of the same value, if that can be said to revive, which has only been dormant for want of employment. But I slander it when I say it slept. 1,000 times have I recollected 1,000 scenes, where our two selves have formed the whole of the drama with the greatest pleasure. At times, too, when I had no reason to suppose that I should ever hear from you again. I have laughed with you at the Arabian Nights entertainment, which afforded us, as you well know, a fund of merriment that deserves never to be forgot. I've walked with you to Netley Abbey. I've scrambled with you over hedges in every direction. And many other feats we've performed together upon the field of my remembrance, and all within these few years. Should I say within this 12-month, I should not transgress the truth. The hours I spent with you were among the happiest of my former days, and are therefore chronicled so deeply in my mind as to fear no erasure. You say you've often heard of me. That puzzles me.
That puzzles me. I cannot imagine from what quarter, but it is no matter. I must tell you, my cousin, that your information has been a little defective. That I am happy in my situation is true, I live and have lived these 20 years with Mrs. Unwin, to whose affectionate care of me during the far greater part of that time, it is, under Providence, owing that I live at all. But I do not count myself happy in having been for 13 of those years in a state of mind that has made all that care and attention necessary. An attention and care that have injured her health, and which, had she not been uncommonly supported, must have brought her to her grave. Oh, William! But I will pass to another subject. It would be cruel to particularise only to give pain. Neither would I by any means give a sable hue to the first letter of a correspondence so unexpectedly renewed. I am delighted with what you tell me of my uncle's good health. To enjoy any measure of cheerfulness at so late a day is much. But to have that day enlivened with the vivacity of youth is much more. Happy for the most part are parents who have daughters. Daughters are not apt to outlive their natural affections. I rejoice particularly in my uncle's felicity, who has 3 female descendants from his little person, who leave him nothing to wish for upon that head.
My dear cousin, dejection of spirits, which I suppose may have prevented many a man from becoming an author, made me one. I find constant employment necessary, and therefore take care to be constantly employed. Manual employments do not engage the mind sufficiently, as I know by experience, having tried many. But composition, especially in verse, absorbs it wholly. I write, therefore, generally 3 hours in a morning, and in an evening transcribe. I read also, but less than I write, for I must have bodily exercise, and therefore never pass a day without it. I have read The Mirror, and many of the papers I admired, but not all. Dr. Beattie is so great a favourite of mine that where he shines, I seem to have no eyes for the beauties of others. I think all the best papers are his. You ask me where I've been this summer. I answer, at Olney. Should you ask me where I've spent the last 17 summers, I should still answer, at Olney. Aye, and the winters also. I have seldom left it, and except when I attended my brother in his last illness. Never, I believe, for a fortnight together.
My book is called The Task. I would order you one from the booksellers, were the publications now my own, but being rather, as you know, the least opulent of those who may be called gentlemen rhymers, I cannot afford to print at my own expense, and am therefore forced to make a present of the copy. Oh, my dear. Adieu, my beloved cousin. I shall not be always thus nimble in reply, but I shall always have great pleasure in answering you when I can. My poor hare, Puss, is in good health, except a cough which never troubled her till this day. Herself, a house dog, and a small spaniel were just now basking in the beams of our fireside, very comfortably in a group. But the great beast Mungo desired to be let into the kitchen just before I could tell you so. He is very fond of Puss, often salutes her with his black muzzle, and licks her face. The bread that she happens to leave is his perquisite, so that he may not be altogether disinterested in his attachment. To me, at Olney, is direction enough. Your friend and cousin, William Cooper.
My dearest cousin, whose last most affectionate letter has run in my head ever since I received it, and which I now sit down to answer 2 days sooner than the post will serve me. I thank you for it, and with a warmth from which I am sure you will give me credit. I do not seek new friends, not being altogether sure I should find them, but have unspeakable pleasure in still being beloved by an old one. I hope that now our correspondence has suffered its last interruption, and that we shall go down together to the grave, chatting and chirping as merrily as such a scene of this as will permit. I'm happy my poems have pleased you. My volume has afforded me no such pleasure at any time, either while I was writing it or since its publication, as I have derived from yours and my uncle's opinion of it. I make certain allowances for partiality, and find myself rich in the measure of approbation that still remains. But above all, I honour John Gilpin, since it was he who first encouraged you to write. I made him on purpose to laugh at, and he served his purpose well. I am now indebted to him for a far more valuable acquisition than all the laughter in the world amounts to, the recovery of my intercourse with you. Now you say you wish to send me gifts, my benevolent and generous cousin. When I was once asked if I wanted anything, and given delicately enough to understand that the inquirer was ready to supply all my occasions, I thankfully and civilly but politely declined the favour. But to you I answer otherwise. I know you thoroughly, and the liberality of your disposition, and have that consummate confidence in the sincerity of your wish to serve me, that delivers me from all awkward constraint, and from all fear of trespassing by acceptance. To you, therefore, I reply yes. Whensoever, and whatsoever, and in what manner soever you please, my affection for the giver is such as will increase to me tenfold the satisfaction I shall have in receiving. Now, in the affair of my next publication, toward which you also offer me so kindly your assistance, there will be no need that you shall help me in the manner that you propose. It will be a large work, consisting, I should imagine, of 6 volumes at the least. The 21st of this month I shall have spent a year upon it, and it will cost me more than another. I do not love the booksellers well enough to make them a present of such labour, but intend to publish by subscription. I will trouble you with some papers of proposals when the time shall come. Now, my dear, I am going to tell you a secret. It's a great secret that you must not whisper even to your cat. No creature is at this moment apprised of it except Mrs. Unwin and her son. I am making a new translation of Homer, and am upon the point of finishing the 21st book of the Iliad. I have not answered many things in your letter, nor can do at present for want of room. I cannot believe but that I should know you, notwithstanding all that time may have done. There's not a feature in your face, could I meet it upon the road by itself, that I should not instantly recollect. I should say, that's my cousin's nose, those are her lips and chin, and no woman on earth can claim them but herself. As for me, I'm a very smart youth for my years. I'm not indeed grown grey, so much as I'm grown bald. Away with the fear of writing too often. Yours, my dearest cousin, William Cooper.
Ah, peace to read William's letter. What, I wonder, has he made of my offer of the writing desk? Let me see. My dearest cousin, I am glad that I always loved you as I did. It releases me from any occasion to suspect that my present affection for you is indebted for its existence to any selfish considerations. No, I'm sure that I love you disinterestedly and for your own sake, because I never thought of you with any other sentiments than those of the truest affection. You have placed me in a situation new to me, and in which I feel myself somewhat puzzled to know how I ought to behave. At the same time that I would not grieve you by putting a check upon your bounty, I would be as careful not to abuse it. Oh, fie, you could do no such thing. My dear, we live, as you know, in a house that has 2 small parlours. The hare has entirely occupied one these 12 years, and has made it unfit to be the receptacle of anything better than the box in which he sleeps. William, my dear! The other which we ourselves occupy is already so filled with chairs, tables, etc., not forgetting our proper persons, as absolutely to forbid the importation of anything more. I have indeed a small summer house in our farthest garden, for we have two, that just affords room to myself, two chairs and a table. There I always write in summer, and there also in winter when the day is bright. Upon that table, indeed, such a desk might stand. But then this is at such a distance from the house, and thieves are so numerous in the town that in all probability it would be stolen. The poor creature! But he shall have a desk upon which to write. I doubt not they could find another position. I must write and press the matter. Now, what does he say concerning the wine I offered to send? Wine, my dearest cousin, is an article on which I have something to say that will not please you, and something that will. You must know that some years since, when we began to feel ourselves a little pinched in our finances, I made a heroic resolution that I would drink no more. Accordingly, I substituted half a pint of a certain malt liquor called ale, much against Mrs. Unwin's will, who opposed the innovation with all her might. But I was obstinate, and had my own way, as I generally have. Ah, me, he's still headstrong! The consequences were such a concert of music within, croaking and scolding of stomach and bowels denied their wonted comfort, and such perpetual indigestions withal, that I was constrained to return to the bottle. I have a stomach that is good for little at the best. I find it necessary, therefore, to drink wine to keep it in tolerable humour, to the amount of 3 or 4 glasses after dinner and supper. A bottle, therefore, serves me 2 days, sometimes 2.5, which I mention principally with a view to commend my own sobriety. I drink nothing but port. The port, therefore, my dear, which you offer me, I accept. It is to me a medicine which I cannot do without, yet a medicine rather too costly for me. Now for the conveyance. We have 2. The Wellingborough coach passes through Olney on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays in its way from London. It sets out from town at 5 in the morning on those days, and starts from the Cross Keys in John Street, Smithfield. Roger's wagon sets out every Wednesday and Saturday from the windmill in St. John Street. Rogers, the proprietor, lives at a village called Sherrington, 3 miles short of Olney, but Olney is the goal he drives at. You are now in the possession of the whole matter. Excellent. I shall make some arrangements at once.
My dearest, dearest cousin, how may I thank you? The desk is the most elegant, beauteous thing. I scarcely dare touch it. And the port wine. You shall have my receipt in verse. Benefactions addressed to my dear cuz, April 14th. This cap that so stately appears with ribbon found tassel on high, which seems by the crest that it rears ambitious of brushing the sky. This cap to my Harriet I owe. She gave it and gave me beside a ribbon, worn out long ago, with which in its youth it was tied. This chair that I pressed at my ease, with tresses of steeds that were black, well covered and wadded to please the sitter both bottom and back, thick studded with bordering nails, smooth-headed and gilded and bright, as Vesper, who when the day fails, adorns the dark forehead of night. These carpets, so soft to the feet, Caledonia's traffic and pride. Oh, spare them, ye knights of the boot, dirt splashed in a cross-country ride. This table and mirror within, secure from collision and dust, at which I oft shave cheek and chin, and periwig nicely adjust. All these are not half that I owe. To one from our earliest youth, to me ever ready to show benignity, friendship and truth. For time the destroyer declared, and foe of our perishing kind, if even her face he has spared, much less could he alter her mind. Now to my letter. Dearest cousin, my desk is always pleasant, but never so pleasant as when I'm writing to you. If I'm not obliged to you for the thing itself, at least I am, for your having decided the matter against me, and resolving that it should come in spite of all my objections. Before it arrived, Mrs. Unwin had spied out for it a place that exactly suits it. As to my frequent use of it, I will tell you how the matter stands. When I was writing my first volume, and was but just beginning to emerge from a state of melancholy that had continued some years, from which, by the way, I do not account myself even now delivered, Mrs. Unwin insisted on my relinquishing the pen, apprehending consequences injurious to my health. When ladies insist, you know, there is an end of the business. Obedience on our part becomes necessary. I accordingly obeyed, but having lost my fiddle, I became pensive and unhappy. She therefore restored it to me, convinced of its utility, and from that day to this, I've never ceased to scrape. Observe, however, my dear, that I scrape not always. My task that I assign myself is to translate 40 lines a day. If they pass off easily, I sometimes make them 50, but never abate any part of the allotted number. Perhaps I'm occupied an hour and a half, perhaps 3 hours, but generally between 2 and 3. This, you see, is labour that can hurt no man, and what I've translated in the morning, in the evening I transcribe. You insisted I should give you my genuine opinion of the wine. By the way, it arrived without the least damage or fracture, and I finished the first bottle of it this day. It is excellent. And though the wine which I had been used to drink was not bad, far preferable to that. I am enamoured of the desk and its contents. A few years ago I made Mrs. Unwin a present of a snuff-box, a silver one. It is of a size and form that make it more fit for masculine than feminine use. She therefore with pleasure accepts the box which you have sent. I should say with the greatest pleasure. Mrs. Unwin said to me a few nights since, after supper, "I have 2 fine fowls in feeding, and just fit for use. I wonder whether I should send them to Lady Hesketh." I replied, "Yes, by all means." My dearest cousin, for whom I feel more than I can say, I once more thank you for all. Which reminds me, by the way, of thanking you in particular for your offer of oysters. I am very fond of them, and few things agree better with me when they're served without butter. Dearest cousin, if you give me wine, there is no good reason wherefore you should also be at the expense of bottles, of which we could not possibly make any other use than to furnish the rack with them, where the cats would break them. I purpose, therefore, to return the hampers, charged with the same number that it brings, by your permission. The difference will be 16 shillings in the price of the wine. You do not ask me, my dear, for an explanation of what I could mean by anguish of mind.
By anguish of mind? Because you do not ask, and because your reason for not asking consists of a delicacy and a tenderness peculiar to yourself, for that very cause I will tell you. A wish so suppressed is more irresistible than many wishes plainly uttered. Know, then, that in the year 73, the same scene that was acted in St. Albans opened upon me again at Olney, only covered with a still deeper shade of melancholy, and ordained to be of a much longer duration. I was suddenly reduced from my wonted rate of understanding to an almost childish imbecility. I did not indeed lose my senses, but I lost the power to exercise them. I could return a rational answer even to a difficult question, but a question was necessary, or I never spoke at all. This state of mind was accompanied, as I suppose it to be in most instances of this kind, with misapprehension of things and persons that made me a very untractable patient. I believed that everybody hated me, and that Mrs. Unwin hated me most of all. Was convinced that all my food was poisoned, together with 10,000 megrims of the same stamp. I would not be more circumstantial than is necessary. Dr. Cotton was consulted. He replied that he could do no more for me than might be done at Olney, but recommended particular vigilance, lest I should attempt my life. A caution for which there was the greatest occasion. At the same time that I was convinced of Mrs. Unwin's aversion to me, I could endure no other companion. The whole management of me consequently devolved upon her, and a terrible task she had. She performed it, however, with a cheerfulness hardly ever equalled on such an occasion, and I have often heard her say that if ever she praised God in her life, it was when she was to have all the labour. She performed it accordingly, but as I have hinted once before, very much to the hurt of her own constitution.
To the hurt of our own constitution. It will be 13 years and little more than a week since this malady seized me. Methinks I hear you ask, your affection for me will, I know, make you wish to do so. Is it removed? I reply, in great measure, but not quite. Occasionally, I am much distressed, but that distress becomes continually less frequent, and I think less violent. I find writing, and especially poetry, my best remedy. Perhaps had I understood music, I had never written verse, but had lived on fiddle strings instead. It is better, however, how it is. A poet may, if he pleases, be of a little use in the world, while a musician, the most skilful, can only divert himself and a few others. I have been emerging gradually from this pit. Soon as I became capable of action, I commenced carpenter, made cupboards, boxes, stools. I grew weary of this in about 12 months and addressed myself to the making of birdcages. To this employment succeeded that of gardening, which I intermingled with that of drawing, but finding that the latter occupation injured my eyes, I renounced it and commenced poet. I've given you, my dear, a little history in shorthand. I know that it will touch your feelings, but do not let it interest them too much. In the year when I wrote the task, for it occupied me about a year, I was very often most supremely unhappy. And I am under God indebted in good part to that work for not having been much worse. You do not know what a clever fellow I am, how I can turn my hand to anything. Adieu, my dear cousin.
I must see him, I must. If it is at Olney, then so be it, for he will not come to me. I hope he can provide for my household. What does he reply to my hopes of June next? Olney, March 1786. 3 long months must pass before we shall see her. I will, however, be as patient as I can, and comfort myself with the thought that we shall meet at last. You said in one of your letters that you had resolved to dream of nobody but Homer and his translator. I hope you keep your resolution. About 3 nights since, I dreamed that, sitting in our summer house, I saw you coming towards me. With inexpressible pleasure I sprang to meet you, caught you in my arms, and said, "Oh, my precious, precious cousin, may God make me thankful that I see thy face again." Now this was a dream, and no dream. It was only a shadow while it lasted. But if we both live, and live to meet, it will be realized hereafter. Oh, my sweet, sweet cousin, how I long to see you.
Dearest Cuz, I'm preparing for your visit. while I write this, Mrs. Yu is gone to attempt a treaty with a linen draper over the way, which, if she succeeds, will be best of all, because the rooms are better. I must halt until she returns. She returns, nothing done. She's gone to another place. Once more I halt. Again she returns and opens the parlour door with these tidings. I've succeeded beyond my utmost hopes. I went to Morris Smith's. I said, do you know if Mr. Brightman could and would let lodgings ready furnished to a lady with three servants? Morris's wife calls out. She's a Quaker. Why dost thou not take the vicarage? I replied, there is no furniture. Pshaw, quoth Morris's wife, we will furnish it for thee, and at the lowest rate, from a bed to a platter, we'll find all. And on what do you intend now? Said I to Mrs. Unwin. Why now, quoth she, I'm going to the curate to hear what he says. So away she goes, and in about 20 minutes returns. Well, now it is all settled. Lady H is to have all the vicarage except two rooms, at the rate of 10 guineas a year. And Morris will furnish it for 5 guineas from June to November inclusive. So, my dear, you and your train are provided for to my heart's content. Come then, my beloved cousin, for I am determined that whatsoever king shall reign, you shall be vicar of Olney.